It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Welcome to this episode of Kennedy Save the World, and today I'm going to save you from underachievement. There are some people in the world who are just too good at too many things, and I've found one of them. It's always fun to find someone who is so deeply impressive, you don't know whether to high-five them or grab a tissue with that free hand and just soak yourself in a puddle of your own tears because you'll never, ever match up to these accomplishments. Neil Hirschman is a nice young man. He's only 27 years old. He has already summited Everest. He has done something called an ultra triathlon, which is continuous. It's not Ultraman that takes place over 3 days. It is one long race, a 7.2-mile swim. Try doing that ever. A 336-mile bike and a 78.6-mile run to top it off. He did that. And he summited Everest. And he has degrees in finance and astrophysics from the George Washington University. He and his wife, Sharon, just had a baby girl, but he's all ready for the sleep deprivation because he's done these crazy races where you race literally for 4 days and you have no idea where you are. And on top of that, he's the CEO of 16 Handles. He also owns Dippin' Dots NYC and Captain Cookie NYC. This is very exciting news because my daughters love 16 Handles. And it is a soft serve emporium. They have frozen yogurt. They have ice cream. They have sorbet. They have a vegan partnership with Oatly. This man has done too much, and he hasn't even reached 30. This is unreal. Neil, I don't know what to say about you other than holy crap.
Well, thank you very much.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for the very warm introduction. I'm very happy to be here.
What's the first thing that you did on this list?
So I always kind of was like a hobbyist, I think it's called, growing up. So I would go into these different activities. And there was this quote that I learned when I was really young about min-maxing your life. And it's like, don't try and do everything. Try and do some things and do them really well and like focus on those. And so that's kind of what I did. And so, you know, some of my first hobbies were like, kind of random. I got into aviation for a while and became a pilot as well.
Sure you did. No, he's flying planes.
And then later on in college, I realized I really liked the space thing. Mm-hmm. And so that was fun. But I also loved business and making money. And so that's where the finance thing came in. And throughout that, I wanted to try my hand at endurance sports. I had seen, I think it was a video on YouTube of, you know, that like Kona, which is the Ironman World Championship, like the finish line
that they
crossing
just had this
videos.
Last weekend.
Yep. Those like videos where you see those people who are like crawling across the finish. And that was so inspiring to me. And I was like, that is something I want to do. I had never ridden a bike before. I'm admitting that as a... I guess I was, 19 or 20 then? I had never ridden a bike. I had to learn I had to learn basically while I was in college how to ride a bike. But I had never swam, and I was just like, that's something I want to do. And that played into a larger goal of mine, which was kind of on the mountaineering side. And ultimately, I wanted to get to the top of Everest. That was always something in the back of my mind since I was really young. But I never really saw the path to get there. And then all of a sudden, the path kind of unfolded itself. And then... I came to New York and I was working in finance and I just didn't see that lifestyle working out for me. And so that's why I kind of went off onto my own businesses. And one of those happened to be a frozen yogurt shop, 16 Handles. And that turned into this little dessert empire in New York. And then it made sense to buy out the franchise itself.
Yeah, people love dessert. They do. They're never going to get sick of it. Dessert is recession proof. But it's very interesting because like you, when I was a kid, my dad was a marathon runner. And, you know, we would do road races and stuff. And in Oregon, you know, running is a religion and everyone runs. Yeah. It's, you know, like in Indiana, everyone plays basketball. In Texas, everyone plays football. In Oregon, you run. You do track. You do soccer as well. But running, like Steve Prefontaine, like his legend permeates through the hearts of all Oregonian children. So I would watch Kona with my dad, and I was the same way. I was like, I want to do a triathlon at some point. And it's interesting because when you get into endurance racing, it's so much of it is overcoming, and you know, it's like that mental challenge where you go through different phases of yourself.
Yep.
And it's like you go through your soothing self, and that's a nice self. And then you go through your really angry self, and the angry self is like, why are you here? Why are you doing this? And, you know, using those and overcoming all of those, it's so critical in endurance sports like that. So have you applied that mentality to other things like owning businesses and summiting Everest? Or is it like, I'm going to find the coolest sounding things that are very impressive, and I'm just going to make a list of cool, impressive things, and I'm going to tick them off one by one?
No, it's definitely exactly that. It's like the endurance sports are so raw, and like you really learn so much about yourself throughout the process, and not even, you know, it's always about first finishing a race, and then when you're actually training for that race, you realize finishing the race is like the least of everything you're doing. And it's the process of getting there and the journey and everything you learn within it. And even during the race, it's like there's times during a race where I'm like, I don't even want to finish this thing anymore. Yep. Like I've been there.
I've been there like mile 8 of a half Ironman. I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. Yep. I don't want to run.
Absolutely.
I do not want to run 5 more miles. I think this is stupid. This is a stupid sport. This is a dumb day. And I have these conversations with myself.
Yeah, there's, you know, you mentioned I do some longer distance stuff as well. And there's times where you're like on mile 5 of a 100+ mile run.
Yeah.
And your ankle hurts and you're like, I'm not going to get through this day. And you just kind of have to work.
Is this training or is this racing?
I race the 100-mile ones. I don't go for fun runs that are 100 miles, though I have friends who do. But to your question, it's no, I don't look at them really because I want these certain accomplishments. It's just things that I think are cool and these different journeys that I can take and spend my time on other than just, you know, sitting at home watching TV or something. And that's what I find myself doing. And I get really addicted to the things that I focus on, which is sometimes a problem. But
do you abandon them? Because, you know, you talk about being inspired by a quote to do something really well. So it sounds like you've done things well, and then you find another thing to do well.
Yeah.
So do you still pilot around for fun, or are you just over planes?
Yeah, so both in a sense. It's like you can't spread yourself too thin. And so at some point, you know, what you're focusing on in the present has to be what you're focusing on, and you can't be everywhere at once. And so a few of my passions and hobbies, you know, have faded over time, but that's also part of life, is like you get interested in different things at different times.
But you're only 27. It's not like you're 57. I mean, you're 27 years old. You're a tiny person. And I don't mean that in a condescending way at all whatsoever. I am overwhelmed by the amount of things you've done in a short period of time and actually appear to have really gotten something out of them.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's hard to give, you know, context when I haven't been older, so I can only speak to kind of what I've been through. But I feel like if you spend your time doing things, and I grew up in like a very adventurous, like we'll go spend our money on traveling somewhere or doing activities instead of buying nice cars or things like that. It's like that's what my parents instilled was important.
Where'd you grow up?
In Westchester, New York. So a little bit north of the city. Yep.
Absolutely. Lyme disease.
Yeah.
That's what I know about Westchester.
Times. Yep.
We have more of this interview in moments coming up.
Fox News Radio on demand on the Fox News app. Download the app and just click listen. When you swipe left, you can listen to your favorite Fox News talk shows live. Swipe right for the latest Fox News Radio newscasts on demand. Fox News Radio on the Fox News app. Download it today.
So tell me about Everest, because, you know, this is something where people who do spend decades mountaineering, Everest is too much for them to grasp. And, you know, it's like we've seen movies, Into Thin Air, that book, I don't know if you read that John Krakauer book, but it is so, I thought John Krakauer did a really, really great job, that and Into the Wild, of explaining how people get drawn to mountains. And like that, the physical and emotional force that's like a magnet that draws you to something that is so much greater than you. And to a lot of people, it's too big. It's overwhelming. And they see and read stories about people who perish because the mountain is so much greater and it has moods. And when it's done with you, it disposes of you. Yep. So how on earth did you get to Everest?
Yeah.
Had you done mountaineering?
Yeah. So I looked at Everest as kind of this, that was the end point, right? That was the Ironman finish line, basically. And so to get there, you read a lot about it. There's tons of movies and videos. And one thing became really obvious is that there's kind of this pay-to-play on Everest idea that was coming to fruition of there's these guiding companies that will take anybody up. And that's kind of where you see the death rates start going up and why you see all this bad press about it. And so I knew I didn't want to go to Everest.
Because the governments give too many permits to these companies, and the company's like, yeah, we don't give a rip if you don't have any mountaineering experience. We'll give you crampons and some oxygen. You know, we got Sherpas. What else do you need?
Yeah. Yeah, there's definitely some foul play on a few different sides. But ultimately, I wanted to do it in a way that was sustainable, but I didn't really know what that meant, right? So it started with smaller climbs in kind of more well-known and more simple mountains that not only were easier to climb, but actually had a well-developed infrastructure on them of you know, training and whatnot. So I started on Mont Blanc in Switzerland and doing some other climbs in Switzerland and did some climbing in New Zealand. And then I went to Nepal for the first time. No, I did Mount Aspiring out there.
Nice.
But so beautiful. Such a fun trip. And I went to Nepal for the first time and just did a trek to base camp.
Okay.
Now, base camp at Everest is still, you know, thousands of feet higher than the top mountain in Colorado. So it's still, you know, an arduous trek to get there. But
can anyone do that, or do you have to have a permit to go to base camp?
No, there probably are some permits, but no, anyone can go for the trek. Not everybody makes it. Some people do have to turn around. It's like, it's still
because
very high.
Because they become hypoxic and...
Yeah. You know, for a few different reasons. It's also, you know, the food there is very limited, and there's so many reasons. But, you know, I did that, and I climbed another smaller peak out there called Island Peak, just kind of as a, let's see what this whole Everest thing is about. And I really loved it out there. I loved the people that I met through the journey thus far. And it kind of instilled in me, okay, Everest is definitely...
Did you feel a connection? Did you feel almost a metaphysical connection with that part of the world? Because you now have some comparison. You're not just climbing peaks in the United States. You've been to Europe. You've been to New Zealand. So how were you differently connected there?
Yeah, I think it's just the attitude that the locals have towards the mountain. I mean, for them, you know, the mountain's very spiritual and godly, and because of that, they want to treat it right, and they treat climbing it as a privilege more than, you know, some kind of accomplishment. It's a privilege to be on the mountain and to be able to kind of see the views from the top, so to speak. And so, you know, that, and also it's just like, it's great fun people. It's not about, you know, living this, you know, kind of New York life of stress and running around and always being late and making more money than the next person. For them, it's just kind of living a more fulfilling, wholesome life. And so being able to kind of balance those two and spend time out there and seeing all that was really nice and really important. And so I think a year later, I went back and climbed a peak out there called Ama de Blam, which, you know, is a little bit of a harder, more technical mountain. Not quite as high as Everest, but, you know, it was a 16-hour summit day. And there's a few spots on that where you're looking down at thousands of feet of drop and you're sleeping on a tent that's kind of hanging off the ledge of the mountain. So that was a great experience. And then COVID hit and everything kind of got put on pause. But at this point I had, made a good friend, Chum Cheng, who is a Sherpa, but he's, Also, he's a Sherpa from, you know, Nepal, but he's also been around the world and guided and, you know, been a, not just an expedition leader, but just a team member and kind of seen different things. And he was looking to grow his own local company. And so this was more of like a test run of him and then us climbing as friends with our other friend, Marius, who's in Dubai. And so we all met in finally April 2022 in Nepal and made the trek out to base camp. And we had our own way of climbing Everest that was a little bit different than most other teams, where we actually didn't want to go back and forth through the Khumbu Icefall, which is that was first, kind of that first day or 2 days up Everest. It's this glacier that's constantly shifting. And so to some extent, you have no control over what happens, because if, you know, 30 tons of ice comes smashing at you, what are you going to do? Even the best climber in the world can't do much. You know, it's more about just climbing it at the right time, which is very early in the morning, right after the deepest freeze, and getting in and out of there. And so we climbed to Camp 2 and spent a while at Camp 2 really waiting for that weather window. It didn't come. So
how long is that? How long is a while? It's like 4 days, two weeks?
No. Yeah, Camp 2, I think on the first time we got up there, I think it's 22,500 feet or so, and we stay there for, I think, about 2 weeks.
It's like two Mount Hoods.
Yeah, it's high, and at that point there's no resources, just the food that we carried up. Yeah, there's obviously no toilets or any luxuries. There's no internet, so it was really us, some books, and just conversations and hanging out. And it's really cold. There was a lot of days where it just snowed, and we basically just stayed in the tent all day, and. And it's great. You get to spend a lot of time in your head thinking about things, but it's also a little bit boring, kind of like at the races, where at some point you're like, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. Why am I sitting
I'm sure
there?
Those thoughts creep in.
Yeah, of course.
You know, it's like, yes, with perspective, you look back and you realize, like, this was life-changing. This, you know, it's like, my soul needed to do this. But when you're in the moment, like, you got to be honest with yourself and be like, this kind of sucks. Like, this part of it, maybe not the greatest part.
Absolutely. But then, you know, 2 weeks later, I'm sitting at Camp 4 knowing that, you know, we're trying to go to sleep and it's like 11 p.m. and we're waking up in 3 hours to go to the summit.
Wow.
And it's like, and then there's no regret.
What's going through
whatsoever.
Your head on summit day? Like, what is your body feeling? Is it comparable to starting a big race? Is it unlike anything you've ever felt?
Yeah, I mean, you're starting in what's called the death zone, right?
So it's there's no oxygen. Like you can't operate.
Yeah. So it's hard to say it's like starting a race, because you're very much already in the race. You know, everything's difficult up there. It's like you're putting on your boots in the tent. And, you know, if you weren't in a rush, even when you're in a rush, it takes you like 10 minutes to zip on a boot. But if you got to move at the pace you'd want to, it would take like an hour to put on a boot, just because you're like, you don't realize it necessarily in the moment, but you also are sort of aware that time is moving differently and your body's moving differently. But the actual work, you know, on summit day of climbing the triangular phase, getting to the balcony, you know, ultimately climbing the south summit to the Hillary Step, which is, you know, a very famous kind of final frontier before you get to the summit ridge. It really felt like a day of work for me. Like, you know, it was just, I had done all this training and all this preparation, and we kind of just kept climbing. And right around sunset or sunrise, we were at the Hillary Step. And I remember probably one of the first words I said is I kind of took down my oxygen mask and I asked Jim, I was like, this is the Hillary Step? And he goes, yeah, Hillary Step. And I was like, oh, okay. And we
when you
going.
Get to that point, are there people who get to Hillary Step who are turned around?
Yeah, so we ended up, because we stayed at camp too long time on our actual summit push, part of the reason we did that is we knew the weather was going to be bad, but then there was this small window and then it was going to be bad again. We were kind of going right between two cyclones. And so some teams waited at base camp to see what that would look like. We went up to camp 2 and used our satellite phone to kind of check in on the weather. And so we were a little bit ahead of some groups. And so we were able to get to, you know, Camp 3, Camp 4 a little bit before them. And so we actually summited and we're basically climbing the mountain alone. We split up into two groups of two or three between me, Marius, Jamchang, Pasang. And so, yeah, I mean, we basically were on there alone. But yes, people do certainly get turned around well before the Hillary step. Earlier in the night, actually, there was a team within an hour from Camp 4 who did have somebody, I think, who went snowblind. And so they were kind of tried to be helped back into their tent, I think, and back into the camp. And then, you know, there are the bodies on Everest, so there's always a reminder.
Do you see them?
You do. I mean, you know, anything above Camp 4, especially that's in the death zone, it's going to take more effort for people to try and bring down those bodies and put them at risk of becoming bodies themselves. And so, you know, for that reason, generally they're kind of left to just freeze and stay because it's not worth risking your own life, you know, to some certain extent to save another one that's, you know, already...
They're dead.
Gone, yeah.
Yes.
So it's hard to say, you know, but... It's the fact.
Is that surreal though, seeing that?
It is. I mean, there's certain steps that you have to take that you're within a few, you know, you're stepping within a foot of a guy who could have been frozen there for, you know, years. And because they're frozen, they're pretty well intact. Mm. And so it's bizarre. But again, you know, for me, it was very much like a day at work and it was about focusing on the climb, focusing on myself, making sure my breathing was good, making sure, you know, I tried to keep my extremities warm and didn't lose any fingers and toes and just kept moving, got to the top, took a photo.
How long were you up there?
Probably like 6 minutes at most.
Wow.
Yeah, I really, I felt like my toes were freezing up and certain fingers went past the point of what felt like frostbite, but you can't check during the time. Like, it's not like you can unzip your boot and be like, oh yeah, those toes are black, or, you know, like, you know, severe frostbite.
Gotta keep
frostbite.
Going, hope for the best.
Yeah, exactly. And so you keep moving, and obviously you have to make the decision of at any point you want to turn around, but we knew with sunrise, we'd get a little bit of sun, and that would help heat us up. The sun up at that altitude is much hotter and much stronger.
Wow, I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Did you get to see the sunrise from the summit, or does it rise before you
get
there?
Yeah, so we saw the sunrise from the summit, and what's cool is I have a picture where you can actually see the shadow of Everest above the horizon during the sunrise. What's strange, though, is most of my summit memories are actually photos that I've taken that are now in my head because we had really strong winds on summit day. It was 40, 45 mile per hour gusts probably. And so there's ice that, you know, gets pelted at you and it sticks to your goggles because the condensation. Mm-hmm. And so I had like this little thin layer of ice on the front of my goggles that I couldn't melt away. And it wasn't worth the time of trying. And so, and you can't take off your goggles because you don't want to go snowblind.
Yes.
The sun and the snow. And so, basically everything was a little bit blurry, at the top of Everest, but I have some pictures and, it really wasn't about necessarily the pictures or the view from the top. It was more the challenge of getting there. And, you know, now that I'm home from it, I didn't even really think about or remember the summit day as much as I do, like the entire journey and all the nights we had at base camp and camp two of me, Marius, and Jamchang just like hanging out and, sharing some popcorn that we made or, you know, the one Snickers bar that we had to cut into thirds and savor and, you know. So,
things like that, like you can't anticipate, but you'll never forget. Was your wife pregnant at the time?
No, that was this year.
So how old is your baby?
6 weeks. The Everest was last year.
Was 21.
Yeah. 21.
Oh, okay. I thought it was 22 and I was gonna, cause if I was your pregnant wife, I'd be like, what the hell are you doing?
No, so one of the goals with Everest in the back of my head was always
do it before you have a kid.
Yeah, do it.
Yeah,
before
it's
kids.
Smart.
Yeah,
you know, it's either that or you do it like long after you have kids, and then you're all tired and creaky.
Yeah.
So what is next? You got to have something on the list.
Yes.
Yeah, got so, more stuff.
I mean, there was just I acquired this company, 16 Handles, and so it's a really big focus right now on building a team around me and building the infrastructure and the system so that we can not only keep our 30 plus units happy and all of our franchisees profitable and successful, but how do we expand that and make it the next national soft serve frozen yogurt player. There's been so many brands that have done it before.
Hey, man, the key to all that is teenage girls. I'm silly with them. So if you ever need tasters or people to be like, oh, my God, this is so gross, just let me know. But I will tell you, like, there is brand loyalty in Absolutely. The Kennedalia household. So congratulations for that. It's very exciting. And at some point, your own child will enjoy these delicious confections. And that will be a new summit in your life.
Absolutely. Her baby naming was at one of the 16 handles. So
that's amazing.
So she didn't get to try it yet, but all the friends and family did.
That's amazing. Well, Neil, it's so good to talk to you. This is so fascinating. It is so deeply inspiring because, you know, you said a word talking about 16 handles that I think can apply to all the different things that you do. And that's systems. Like when you come up with systems and you apply them, It really, like, your life and your experiences are limitless.
Yep. Thank you so much for having me.
Yes. This has been Kennedy Saves the World. I'm Kennedy.
For more podcasts from my friends at Fox, you can go to foxnewspodcast.com. You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Oh, go ahead and leave me a review while you're there. I'd love to hear what you have to say. You've been listening to Kennedy Saves the World on the Fox News Podcast Network.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.